Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is June 4th, 2003. Today's session is Historic Preservation of Holden, Stewardship of the Built Environment, Carrots and Sticks, Strategies for Preserving Historic Places, presented by John Lauber, number LAJ 2003-03. Let's listen in.
Everybody awake?
Yes.
Everybody have coffee? Okay, well, I'll clap my hands now and then to wake you up. Well, I think we'll get going. I think just about everybody's here, if not everybody. Looks like we've got a good crowd. In sort of continuing through our continuum of conversations about historic preservation, today I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that can be done to make historic preservation happen. And it's kind of an interesting collection of strategies, and as the title suggests, some things that are incentives and very appealing, and some things that a lot of people look at as being whacked over the head with a baseball bat. So we're going to talk about some of those things this morning. I think a lot of people think of historic preservation, and the first thing they think of is, well, somebody's going to tell me to do something I don't want to do. This is actually a sign from the New Ulm, Minnesota Heritage Fest. And there were heritage police, but I have to say it wasn't the historic preservation people. It was the people trying to keep those Germans from drinking too much beer. But I think that's a common attitude. Preservation is often seen as a purely regulatory function. And the idea that most people have in their heads is that, you know, that the purpose of that regulation and the purpose of that policing action is to stop the wrecking ball or stop the bulldozer. Whereas in truth, it's in many ways, I hate to say this out loud, but preservation is a very weak process in a lot of ways. It relies heavily on negotiation and consensus building rather than on any overt authority. There's really no enforcement mechanism attached to preservation. There's a lot of emphasis on process, and that's part of what we'll talk about this morning. Yesterday we had two people here from the state of Washington who are helping Holden through that regulatory process, and if you remember, a couple of key things. One is that Holden has been listed or determined eligible for the National Register. So somebody has said this is a historic place. And Holden also exists on U.S. Forest Service property by virtue of a permit. And because of those two things, Holden and the Forest Service and the State Historic Preservation Office constantly sit down to negotiate and talk about how to take care of this place so that its historic character is retained in the long run. The specific laws that pertain are two. One is Section 106 of the Historic Preservation Act of 1966, and the second is Section 4F of the Transportation Act of 1966. Many historic preservation projects have to do with highway work, as you might imagine. You know, the DOTs from every state need to build roads. They're well-funded, and when you build a road, it has to go someplace, and often there's something else that was there first. So here's a highway project. This is an interesting highway project. This actually predates the Historic Preservation Act of 1966. This is a freeway tunnel that was built in the Twin Cities. If you look at the bottom, you'll see a river, and if you look kind of through the middle of the slide, you'll see another river. The one that goes sort of up and down is the Mississippi River. The one that goes off the bottom of the screen is the Minnesota River, and that triangle that's formed up in the left quadrant is the location of historic Fort Snelling, which in 1960 was pretty much reduced to a ruin. There was one round observation tower, a stone tower remaining from the original fort, some ruins of walls, But most of the buildings from the historic fort, which was built in 1819, which in Minnesota history is pretty old, most of the buildings from that period were gone. The freeway highway department wanted to put I-94 through that area. And they could see no reason why I-94 shouldn't just be able to go through that area unfettered. Well, there was a local preservation effort. Some people said we need to retain these vestiges of historic Fort Snelling, which, by the way, was the headquarters for the Dakota Territories, which basically was everything from the Mississippi River west. So Montana, Wyoming, the Dakotas, Washington, all those places were part of the Dakota Territory at one point. And the administrative offices were in St. Paul at Fort Snelling. So it was a pretty important place, but not much of it was left. But through the activities of local advocates, the highway department was talked into, instead of running right over the fort site, they went under the fort site. So this is a tunnel that goes beneath the historic fort area. The main historic part is right out in here. Today that has all been reconstructed. If you go to Fort Snelling today, you see basically the 1819 fort in its full glory. But it very nearly was lost through a freeway project.
Is that an actual tunnel or is it built?
It was a constructed tunnel. As I said, the process of historic preservation, the process of making it happen from a regulatory standpoint is really a negotiation process. And the negotiations are always pointed toward that federal agency. What you're trying to do is to get the federal agency to do something to avoid an adverse effect on a historic property. And here's a list of what some of those adverse effects are. Physical destruction or damage, if you tear something down, that's an adverse effect. If you alter it so that it's no longer retains its historic character, if you remember that lookout shelter I showed you yesterday, which had been raised 10 feet, it kind of lost its historic character. So that kind of alteration. If you move something, it's no longer a place, it's a thing. If you change the use, and this is where we start getting into some fine points, but if you built an aircraft hangar and you turn it into a skating rink, that's a big change in use, and the federal agency has some responsibility to make sure that change is done in a way that the change can happen, but it needs to be done in a sensitive way that retains the features of that historic resource. Introduction of incompatible elements. If you had a historic Fort Snelling and you turned it into a McDonald's and you put a bunch of golden arches all over it, that would be introduction of incompatible elements. Demolition by neglect. This is a strategy that has often been used either willfully or through lack of funds by federal agencies. They have something that's surplused. It's no longer useful to the agency. It's allowed to stand until it deteriorates so far that it can't be brought back. And transfer, sale, or lease of land or property from federal control. So in the case of Fort Snelling in recent years, there was the historic part and there was a sort of later part that was used through World War II as a staging point for the Army. That land was recently sold to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And because there was a land transfer, there were covenants put on the deed saying that the historic character of these places, these buildings, needs to be protected in the long run. So those are the kinds of things we're negotiating about.
I'm thinking that if you have a mine and you change it into a Christian camp, that certainly is a change in use.
It is. This is an adaptive reuse process. What's interesting about this is that it happened before the Historic Preservation Act, and it happened 30 years before this place was designated as a historic site. So the
clever defense.
Well, no, but the conversations here are fairly recent because it's only within the last 10 years that the historic character of Holden has been an issue. And so we've got not only the mining period to deal with, but also all the changes that happened in that preceding time, which were fine. You know, it wasn't a historic site at that point. So there's been a lot of, jockeying for position, if you must say. The way to avoid some of these problems, these adverse effects, really, in an ideal world, comes down to two things. You plan ahead. This is a freeway project on paper, with all the building footprints shown and the right-of-way, the alignment for the roads shown, so that people have a chance to look at it, figure out where it's going, figure out what might be affected, and if need be, work with the engineers to tweak that a little bit to minimize the effects. If that's not possible, if you can't completely avoid the adverse impact, then you mitigate that impact. And that can be done a number of ways. We talked about a bridge project. Hilton brought up a bridge in Minnesota. I said I was surprised that they hadn't documented it and torn it down, because that's a mitigation process that's fairly inexpensive and satisfies some of that need for a record of what was there historically. There are many, many ways to mitigate impacts. Sometimes they make you put up some plaques. If you walk down the road to Winston Camp, you'll see a plaque that talks about what was at Winston Camp, the family town site for Holden. So there are a lot of ways to mitigate impacts. It doesn't always mean you got to move the road. But planning and mitigation are two good strategies for dealing with those adverse impacts. The one that really kicks people, another type of regulation that really I think is in people's heads when they think of historic preservation is the whole issue of design review. I get the question very often, if I put my house on the National Register, will they tell me what color I have to paint it? Well, you can see in this illustration that there might be some reason for design review. But here's kind of the... Here's another example of the attitude, I guess. Once I tried to change the laces and the Landmarks Commission came down on me like a ton of bricks. This idea, you can't change anything. If your house is on the National Register, your building is on the National Register, we start with a set of standards that define ways to deal with that property to avoid some of these adverse impacts. And it's a kind of design review. I brought copies of this, which we can talk about a little later. But let me just read you some of the things that are included in these standards. There's only 10 of them. There's 10 things you need to be thinking about when you have a historic property and you want to avoid some of these impacts in terms of design issues. First of all, if possible, you use the property for its historic purpose. Because as soon as you change functions, you have to change other things. You retain and preserve the historic character of the property. That's pretty vague. The removal of historic materials and alteration of features and spaces that characterize a property shall be avoided. These are all pretty common sense. If you want it to be the same, you don't change it too much. Each property shall be recognized as a record of its own time, place, and use. So changes that create a false sense of historical development. This was really popular with the WPA projects in the 30s. They'd take an 1850s house and they'd turn it into a beautiful colonial home. It might be in Nebraska, but it would look like it had started out in New Hampshire someplace because they made it better than old. More historic than it really was. So you basically try to retain what's there and leave it alone. Properties change over time. That's written right in here. There's an acknowledgement that somebody may have added on to a building or may have changed the windows or doors or changed the paint color, and that's okay. What you try to do is pick a period of time that defines the importance of that place and adhere as closely as you can to that period of time. You try to preserve distinctive features, finishes, and construction techniques are examples of craftspersonship that characterize a property. This is the one I like the best. Deteriorated historic features shall be repaired rather than replaced. Where the severity of deterioration requires replacement, the new features shall match the old as closely as possible. Again, pretty common sense. Chemical or physical treatments, such as sandblasting, should be avoided because they cause damage to the physical fabric of the building. Archaeological resources shall be protected and preserved. If they must be disturbed, document them. New additions are related. This is an interesting one. New additions, exterior alterations, or related new construction shall not destroy historic materials that characterize the property. And the new work should look different from the old work. You ought to be able to look at something and say they added on to that historic property at some point. Doesn't mean it should be, you know, bright orange as opposed to stone or something, but it means you try to reflect the character of that architecture or the nature of that building, but you also want people to know that that wasn't there 100 years ago. And then also, if you do add on or significantly change a building, you try to do it in a way that can be reversed. So if you put an addition on, you might put a breezeway between the addition and the main property, and at some point, if somebody wanted to restore that place, all they'd have to do is take out that link and they're back to where they started. So that's kind of the basic starting point for most of the design review guidelines. At the National Register level. There's also another layer of regulation which happens at the local level, and it has a lot more teeth in it. And I think this is what often people are thinking about when they think of control of historic properties. The caption here says Landmarks Commission, I think. They arrive in a carriage, everybody else is driving a new Buick. And the Landmarks Commissions really do have the authority. It's a local ordinance added to usually to a zoning code, an overlay ordinance that specifically deals with historic districts or historic buildings in a community. And that ordinance appears by vote. So the community has to have some consensus that this is worth doing, and they have to agree that they're willing to follow through on it. But it's designed to avoid things like this. This is the architectural manifestation of not being told, well, the guy in the picture who was wearing five kinds of plaid and a vest. Maybe it's okay to be told what color to paint your house if you have taste like this. It's very interesting. But if you were the neighbors, you might be unhappy about it. And admittedly, it's a very extreme example. But here's a little bit less extreme example. This is a page from the design guidelines from the city of Iowa City, Iowa, which has a great number of Italianate houses. And you can see some of the features of an Italianate house in the illustration. These houses would have dated typically from the 1870s and 80s. Many of them had very interesting paint schemes. Not quite as fabulous as some of the San Francisco Victorians, but they were interesting color combinations nonetheless. The local ordinance was passed to protect these places. It did include some discussion of paint colors. So what they did was created a booklet that basically, in very brief fashion, identified some of the key features of these houses, talked about some of the paint colors that might be appropriate, and talked about some things that you might not want to do. And gave those to all the property owners so that they had a clear understanding of kind of how to approach a project before they started doing the work. Another thing that comes up very often, especially in historic districts, and we've got a case like that here at Holden. If you go up Chalet Circle, we've got 14, the chalets go through number 14, but there are only 13 there, and that's because Chalet 2 burned down in 1968. So there's a gap tooth there. If you look closely, there's a foundation there, and soon there will be a new building there. That's called infill construction, where you've got a district, you've got a whole bunch of historic buildings, and there's an empty space, and you're going to fill that empty space with something. Well, you could fill it with something like this.
Does anybody know why they painted that one blue?
I think there actually are two chalets that are
blue.
And they've been that color ever since I've been here. So they may be original colors. I don't know. Let's look at some other examples of infill. This is a Grand Avenue in St. Paul. It's part of a historic district. A little neighborhood commercial district built up originally around streetcar lines. And if you look down the streetscape here, the building in the foreground on the left is an old Studebaker dealership that's been converted into a fancy restaurant. And if you look further down the block, you see another nice set of commercial buildings, sort of the same scale. They're all two stories, kind of masonry construction, nice cornices on the top. You get a little closer and you see it's a Pottery Barn and a Gap and a J. Crew. That building has been there for about a year. But the architects worked carefully to pick up on some of the features that were historic. They didn't exactly duplicate them. It's a simplified version of what was there. You see the Studebaker building, some of the shapes and some of the use of materials. And then you go down the street to Pottery Barn, and you still got brick, and you still got some nice window configurations and some cornices and so forth. It fits in very well to this neighborhood, and yet it's clearly, you can clearly look at that and say that's a new structure.
Are those false windows above on the second floor, or are they real?
I think some of them are real and some are false. I think the ones above Pottery Barn are false, and the ones further down are apartments or offices, so have actual windows. This is another infill building. We call this, this is on Summit Avenue, a block over from Grand in St. Paul. This is it's described as the best preserved Victorian streetscape in America, this district that we're in. We call this the Miami Vice House because when it went up, it's a stucco house. It's gray now, but it was bright pink. And if you look just off to the upper right-hand corner, you can see just a little hint of what's next door, which is a lot more typical for Summit Avenue. We'll pull back a little bit and still only see a hint of what's next door. But you can see that this definitely, it would be hard to not realize that this was new construction in a historic district, so they did that part right.
Was the color changed by pressure from the city, or did they decide pink wasn't their color?
The design guidelines that the city of St. Paul passed do not specify paint color, so this was a change that was made due to pressure from neighbors. Here's what's next door on the right. Here's where that pointed tower comes from, and you may remember this from yesterday. I showed you a picture of F. Scott Fitzgerald writing something. Well, this is where he lived. It's a National Historic Landmark. So right next door, you've got a really good example of postmodern architecture right in the middle of a Victorian neighborhood. We're going to get away from regulation a little bit because there are other ways to accomplish historic preservation. Increasingly, historic preservation is seen as something that can be used for economic development, and there are a number of ways at this. Probably the one we're most familiar with is adaptive reuse. We'll talk about that in a minute. A lot of communities have started to define their communities as a destination for shopping or tourism. In the case of shopping, we're talking often about a historic main street that maybe saw hard times for a few years and has been brought back and refurbished and revitalized. Heritage tourism, many, especially rural communities, see that as a way to bring in money from outside the community and revitalize and refill their coffers. Here's an example of an adaptive reuse. The caption says, "Great for worship then, great for retail now." So you got a church that's about to be adaptively reused. It's not going to be used for the original purpose, but it's going to be used for something different. And here's an example from the Twin Cities. This is the Grain Belt Brewery Complex, built in 1891 by the Milwaukee brewing architects, Buechner and Orth. This is an architectural firm that specialized in breweries and built them all over the Midwest. A fabulous brew house building, as well as a complex of other things, a bottle house, an office building, a whole bunch of other stuff associated with this. This is what it looked like in 1891. This is what it looked like about 15 years ago when I was in there. The brewery had closed in 1976, stood vacant for a number of years, eventually went into tax forfeiture. The city acquired the property and boarded up the windows and sat on it for a bunch of years and tried to figure out what to do with this place. And as you can see, it didn't do too well during that period. It was a very attractive place for pigeons. And so when I first went in there, I came out with my socks full of pigeon guano at the end. That's one of the occupational hazards I face. This is what it looks like now. After nearly 25 years of trying to figure out what to do with this place, a local architectural firm that does work for the Target stores all over the country that had expanded way beyond the capacity of its original office building needed place for 300 architects to work. This brewery site is right on the Mississippi River, lots of windows, lots of open space inside. They, with the help of the city, some financial assistance and some federal tax credits, took on this project, redeveloped it, and it now is home of RSP Architects. There's that interior staircase that we saw earlier, and there's where the architects work.
So is that still a historic site now?
Yes, it is. And that's where that negotiating takes place. Basically what happened there was a lot of emphasis put on retaining key exterior features and then certain interior things like that staircase that were considered sort of public space. That was rehab too. But the rest of it was allowed to be changed because that was the only way to keep that building standing. Downtown revitalization is another strategy that's used by many, or another preservation strategy. The idea behind this, which is, there's a program called Main Street Program that's formulated by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, that has a four-point approach to using historic preservation for downtown revitalization. Design, you pay attention to the physical design of your buildings and try to retain that historic character as a marketing feature. You say, we've got a historic downtown here, come and shop in our historic downtown. Promotion, you promote it, you do some events, you do a sidewalk days or you do a downtown festival and you try to draw people to the community. You do very carefully thought out economic development, often focused around things like retaining businesses from your community, and if they're going to expand, you try to get them to expand downtown so that you keep those buildings full. And then organization, which I should have probably said first, but you create a local organization to kind of run all this stuff, a little bit like a chamber of commerce, but that kind of monitors this. About 2 weeks ago, the downtown of Wenatchee was named the Great American Main Street for 2003. They won a national award for the revitalization of their Main Street. They're part of this program. So if you go back that way, you might want to drive around town a little bit before you head home. One of the things the Main Street program typically does is create a set of design guidelines that helps downtown business owners figure out how to deal with these buildings, which often have been greatly altered. You can see here probably a 60s alteration. We've all seen a lot of buildings like this. Lots of signs all over the outside. The windows have been changed. The upper floors, who knows what's back there. That's the before. That's the after.
That's better.
This is an architect's idea of how to deal with that. And most Main Street programs try to get pretty specific with the buildings that are in that downtown area. Often they'll create revolving loan funds or offer technical assistance, maybe have a staff architect who will come in and work with the business owner. They try to keep it practical, but they try to recreate the original appearance of those places as a marketing tool.
The San Diego City made a gas lamp district, and it is just going over like gangbusters.
I think that's probably a very similar idea. Here's another sort of before and after. You can see the before down in the little inset photo. It's pretty nondescript neighborhood in Wheaton, Illinois, and an architect's idea of what that could be. So part of the Main Street program is really to get people to buy into a vision of what they want their community to be and what they think it could be, and then work toward that goal. it's historic preservation, but it also is economic development for the community. Another thing that's grown in recent years is an interest in heritage tourism. We've talked about a number of these places over the past few days. A lot of you have been to Williamsburg or Freedom Walk in Boston, or going to go to San Francisco to look at the Painted Ladies, the beautiful Victorian houses. We've all done some heritage tourism, I think. But some places have gotten very explicit about creating organizations that bring people together to work on this as a means, again, of economic development, trying to bring dollars to their communities from outside. One that I know a little bit about is in Iowa. It's a program called Silos and Smokestacks. It's a national heritage area. It's an interesting idea because what it is a strip that runs from the very northern edge of Iowa to the very southern edge of Iowa, and about a third of the way in from the east. And it's a group of communities that have pooled their resources. They've created things like visitors' guides or cassette tape tours that you can put in your tape player in your car and drive down a highway, and there'll be numbers on a map, and at each stop you turn on the tape and it'll tell you about something historic that happened there. It's everything from the John Deere tractor plant in Waterloo, Iowa, to the Vesterheim Norwegian American Museum in Decorah. It's administered by the National Park Service, but it's not really a national park. It's just kind of a confederation of communities that have gotten together and worked on this project. The photos here show the Amana Colonies, which is another, it was a utopian communal society created in southern Iowa in the 1800s. And you do whatever you have, Amana microwaves or refrigerators, that's what they're doing today. Here's another shot of the Amana Colonies. This was the communal church before and after in the 1850s and now. But it's just a matter of sort of repackaging what's already there and telling people about it. Another thing that, the caption, the old pearly gates look nice, but they were hell to maintain. You see what they've got is a chain link fence. Well, one of the things we discover in this field is that a lot of people have good intentions about preserving historic buildings, but don't necessarily know how to go about it. The materials are different from what you can get at Menards or Home Depot. They can't find carpenters who know how to do the work, or they can't do the work themselves, and they sort of don't know how to proceed. So most state preservation offices try to offer technical assistance. Every state office has to have a historical architect on staff, and that person is available to consult with people. And you can see another technical issue here. See, that's your problem right here. The roof is mostly sugar. You solve that, you fix the maintenance headache. But there's some other ways at this. There's a whole series of preservation briefs that have been created by the National Park Service to deal with specific issues. This one could have helped that last property owner because it's about roofing for historic buildings. These things vary in scope from a 4-page little handout like this to maybe a 30-page full-color document on how to restore stained glass windows. They're not the be-all and end-all, but a lot of times it's a good starting point for somebody that has a particular problem. They deal with windows and ceramic tile and mortar mixes and all kinds of, to me, really fascinating stuff about how buildings go together. And at this point, I think there are about 40 of these. And there's a lot of information out there about how to take care of historic buildings. Much of that is available from your state historic preservation office, so technical assistance. There are a few financial assistance opportunities left, although they're dwindling in this economy. There are some federal rehabilitation tax credits available for National Register properties that are income-producing commercial properties. Some states have a state version of that program. There are some loan programs. Often, as I mentioned, the Main Street programs will have a revolving loan program where you can get a no-interest or low-interest loan to do a storefront rehab. And some states have grant programs for various kinds of projects. I'm going to show you now a sort of case study that combines a number of these things we've talked about, including some of the financial incentives. Marianne, I think we were talking the other day about your first Church of Christ Scientist. Well, this is the first Church of Christ Scientist in Fairmont, Minnesota, in the southwest corner, a little prairie town. It was the second Church of Christ Scientist in Minnesota, and it was built shortly after Mary Baker Eddy sort of launched the whole project. This was built in 1895, so pretty close to the origins of the Christian Science Church. This is what it looked like in the 1940s. It's a building that was designed by a very prominent Minneapolis architect named Harry Wild Jones in the Romanesque style, and using a type of stone that is only found in that corner of Minnesota, known as Sioux quartzite. It's a beautiful red stone, extremely hard, but just absolutely gorgeous. And then you can see some banding there along the windows and around the windows. That's made of Kasota stone, which is a very warm yellow limestone found in Minnesota. So that's a black and white photo from the 40s. This is what it looked like three summers ago when I was there. There had been some roofing problems that had been allowed to go a little bit too long. You can see quite a bit of moss on that north side of the roof there. It had internal gutters, not gutters that hung outside the eaves, but gutters that actually were built into the roof system and drained through the building. Those had all rusted out, and so water for a number of years had been pouring into the cavity between the inside wall and the outside wall. And we live in Minnesota. It gets really cold there in the wintertime, so if you've got a wall full of water and it freezes, it starts shoving on those beautiful Sioux quartzite stones, and you can see the result. Well, this building is about as far gone as anything I had seen, but we did a couple of things. Our office has a technical assistance program known as the reuse study process, where we put together a team of people. We have an architect, we have a planner, a city planner, which is usually me, an economic development person, and then depending on ideas people in the community have for how they might want to use a vacant or troubled building, we might have a museum specialist or an arts specialist or somebody else. But we bring that team to town, we do a careful analysis of the building to identify problems and start to prescribe some solutions for the problems. We talk to people in the community to find out about, you know, do people like this place? Do they want to see it stay or do they want a parking lot there? Talk to as many people as we can, have a couple public meetings, and then boil all that stuff down and see what we come up with. Well, in this case, there was a very active group of seniors who had successfully rehabilitated a historic house down the street and felt that this place should stay and that it should be opened as a community hall. It had a beautiful room about twice the size of this room with a 30-foot ceiling in it. They thought it would be perfect for a recital space or just as a community room, a meeting room. So they put a little money into the pot, and our office put a little money into the pot, and they started to rehab this place. And the way they did it was to dismantle that back third of the building. You can see the pallet with the stones on it. Each of those stones was removed, first photographed in place, removed, numbered, palletized, put in a warehouse, and they put up a temporary wall and fixed the roof. That's what it looks like now. Boarded up the windows. It's not beautiful, but it looks better than it did. And with that work completed, they're currently have launched a capital campaign to try to raise the money to finish the project.
The city owns it now?
This was interesting too. The county owned it through tax forfeiture, and under Minnesota law, they have to offer those tax forfeited properties to the city first. Mm-hmm. City didn't want to touch it. but because of the interest of this citizens group, the city was convinced that this would not be an eyesore for very long, and they actually accepted it from the county, And they have also thrown some money into the pot to bring this project around.
So they're going to try to do a capital. I don't know if you have other things to show on this, but for the capital,
just the other side.
Capital money raising, what do they want to do other than put the walls back up? What will they do with, like, the windows? Will they try to...
They will restore the entire building. They have a stained glass studio that's working on the window restorations as we speak, and they're doing it a window at a time. People will fund restoration of a window. The uses of this is right across the street from the County Historical Society, which is out of room, so some of their functions will move into the lower level where the reading room was. The local genealogical society will move in there too. Now this, you know, these aren't uses that create a lot of cash flow.
Right.
But they're uses, and they pay a little bit of rent, and this is a project that will be completed with philanthropic dollars, primarily. And then the upper level will be used, as I said, for community meetings, but also a block away is another successful project in this small community. They recently 20 years ago, they rehabbed an opera house that is actively programmed. They bring in nationally prominent performers on a regular basis, 3 times a week in the summer, but also have smaller events that they'd like to do, and so they'll use this as a satellite facility. So the prospects are pretty good for this place. Another thing we do is stuff like what we're doing here. We do public education, and one program that's been really fun for me. I grew up in rural Iowa. We've done a number of barn preservation workshops and discovered that people are really interested in the barns on the family farm. They see these places as almost a member of the family, but they're big buildings, they're obsolete buildings, and therefore they're really tough to deal with. We've done 4 of these barn workshops in Minnesota. We've had 125 people at every one of them, and we've turned away 300 each year. There's a tremendous amount of interest in this. You know, it's the typical sort of sit in a room and listen to somebody talk. In this case, it was Rudy Christian, who's a master timber framer from Ohio. We offer a little technical assistance. He shows how you can do the work to fix up a barn, even if it's sagged pretty far, and then tries to just answer questions and be a resource to people. We also go look at some barns. This is a blurry picture that I tried to take while standing on a school bus. And here's where we go. We go and look at some of these places. And the last thing I'll talk about today is just advocacy. You've all heard the stories about people who sit in front of the bulldozer or ride the wrecking ball.
Yeah.
That's still part of preservation, and it is a mechanism, and in some cases it's been very effective. This is, I can't tell you what community this is, it's in California somewhere, but you can see a group of activists are trying to save something, and I want to show you what they're trying to save. So, those are the pictures for this morning, but do you have questions or comments, or let's talk a little bit.
I wonder if there'll be time in your schedule when we can, in view of all these things that we've been thinking on during your illustrated lectures, talk and think about Hulu.
That's what I'm hoping to do on Friday.
Okay.
And Don and I are going to switch time periods, I think, because... you're leaving in the morning, so I'll be doing the 2 o'clock slot. And one of the things, I'm trying to put together some pictures of some of the issues here. Mm-hmm. And then we may go look at a couple buildings and let's talk about the planning process that's going on here. But that's, it'll be a less formal presentation than what we've had.
Okay, I think our experience with the facilities, we'll bring some things to the surface.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of stuff that needs to be
talked
about.
The federal government and all of the states are operating on a reduced budget. What have they done to your budget?
Well, they fired me. So my personal budget's in a shambles at the moment. It's real tough times for this enterprise. It's not a time when government activity is looked upon kindly by the majority, I guess. The money that's there in terms of grants and technical assistance is probably going to be way down for the next few years. And I think what that means is that there will be great reliance on local will and local energy to accomplish some of these things.
What is the success of these Main Street revitalizations? Can they compete with the Walmarts and the...
They don't really try to compete with the Walmarts. If you've been to a Main Street community, I almost hesitate to use this term, but I think you'll find almost boutique retail. It's specialty retail rather than, going and buying shampoo and soap.
And do the communities themselves, are they able to support it, or are they always a tourism?
No. There's kind of a critical mass in terms of size of community. For Main Street to really work well, you need a town with about 20,000 people. So these aren't tiny towns. Mm-hmm. But at that point, you've got a big enough retail base and also generally a territory that's coming in that you can support some of these places. But the Main Street organization, one of the things they do is... require extremely careful record keeping in a very specific way. They can document that for every dollar spent on a Main Street program, $3 come into the community in terms of economic development. So, the books come out in the black.
I don't know if Walla Walla is part of this, but they have a very interesting situation there. What happened on Main Street in Walla Walla is that the Bon Marché, the main department store, mm-hmm. had a long-term lease on a building that they had restored. It was an old theater, and they restored it into sort of an arcade and their main store. And they couldn't get out of their lease, so they decided to stay, and that really kept the downtown going. And recently, somebody who had a lot of money restored the Marcus Whitman Hotel, the tall mm-hmm. hotel, into a convention center, and really did a wonderful restoration job. And now Walla Walla is a major destination point for wine industry and boutique wineries. So a lot of wineries have opened tasting rooms and restaurants in town. A lot of buildings are being restored. Mm-hmm. It's just a really lovely little area. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to visit.
There's some other things that happen. If you're a relatively small community, a small city, and you're trying to get industry to come to town, or you want to get a doctor to come to town, and they walk downtown and see that all the buildings are empty and deteriorating, that can make it a pretty tough sell. If you've got a thriving downtown that looks like it's been cared for and is active, it's a soft benefit, but it's definitely a benefit. So there are other parts of this that maybe aren't pure dollars and cents.
Washington has a couple of classic examples of communities that have gone together to make a destination point, like Leavenworth,
yeah.
with its Bavarian style,
yep.
and
Dare Safeway.
Even the Safeway store, the McDonald's, everything in town had a Bavarian flavor. Winthrop, which went western, although a big share of it burned down a year ago, I think it's going to be rebuilt, but it's Leavenworth has, they've just gone full hog into the Bavarian things, and so they have something going on all the time to draw tourists in summer, winter, fall.
And this is just another way at it, kind of.
Another way about it, yeah.
Walmart has come up a couple of times. There have even been a couple of creative collaborations, I guess, with Walmart. In Rutland, Vermont, Walmart wanted to come in. It's a nice little community in Vermont. Walmart wanted to come in. People were very upset about it because they thought our downtown was going to dry up and blow away. Well, Walmart typically comes in quietly and acquires a site without really talking to anybody about it, builds their store. It's outside of town, a little place, lots of parking around it. In Rutland, somebody figured this out at way up front and managed to get Walmart officials to come to the table to talk. and they convinced Walmart to actually build a store in the downtown commercial district, right in the district, and they also got them to design it in a way that fit in with the other buildings in the district. Their idea was, people love Walmart, they're coming to Walmart. If it's right in the downtown, they're also going to be coming to our downtown. So that was a stroke of genius. You got the best of both worlds.
In Santa Fe, all the all the houses look like pueblos, or at least they're that brownish color. Yeah, I think that's an interesting town.
That's the result of very long-standing, very stringent design ordinance.
How does this organization feel about, in the days when, well, Coca-Cola for one, and car dealerships painted their ads on the sides of buildings, and how do they feel about refurbishing those signs, or do they just want them to kind of be there, and then when they go, they go? The reason I'm asking is because one of the women's organizations I belong to in Ellensburg has refurbished three good-sized signs, mm-hmm. two of which are Coca-Cola signs, and one is car dealership. And now one of the restaurant owners has stepped in and is helping. There were two dry cleaning. How did they, the one archaeologist in Ellensburg, or the gentleman that owned one of the buildings, did not want the sign refurbished. He wanted it just to kind of go away. I mean, to maintain its old
appearance.
And the lady that does the refurbishing has researched the kind of paint and is able to find it and does it exactly as much as she can, like it was done originally.
There are signs on the National Register of Historic Places. I showed you the Grain Belt Brewery.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful Grain Belt Brewery sign, a huge thing that looked like a big bottle cap with neon all over it, that's on the National Register in Twin Cities. And signs are typically considered to be part of the historic fabric, and so can be restored. And, you know, there may be differing opinions about it, but it's not outside the realm of preservation to restore a sign.
Can I just mention that villages and cities, certainly downtown districts, through the regulatory process of the village council or the city government, whatever it is, can regulate signs, regulate size, regulate everything about it.
And most local historic preservation ordinances have a sign section.
Where are those Burma Shave signs? Why aren't they
out there? They're at the Minnesota Historical Society Archives, because that's where they were created.
We need them on the road again.
Yep.
It only causes accidents.
It's putting this new CD in the changer that causes the
freeways.
Right.
At 70 miles an hour, you might run into somebody if you're reading the Burma Shave sign.
I think cell phones are a bigger hazard.
Oh, yes. And eating.
Did you tell us where this was?
I know it's in California, and beyond that, I don't know, Hope. I'm sorry,
you
but...
I think that might be... Is it really round?
Salt Bay was the old place.
Well, I think we're looking at a fisheye view, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, because I'm thinking that down by Disneyland, there was a...
The boots and hats. Somebody wanted to move that to Ellensburg.
Yeah.
Oh, they moved it. The boots and the hat. There was a gas station that was a huge pair of cowboy boots and hats.
And a hat.
And
he sat for years.
They're moving it to a park in the same area where it was.
Oh, good.
The one in this part of the world that I remember is there's some place that has a giant coffee pot.
Teapot. It's a teapot.
Okay.
And it's between Yakima and Grandview, somewhere down, or Yakima and Sunnyside. And it's on the back. It's on the on the freeway. You have to do the back road.
Yeah.
But it's cute.
There's one in Tacoma on the Highway 99.
You know what? I think we could start a sign preservation group here.
Yeah.
Yes. One of the things they've had in Ellensburg with their historic buildings are the awnings. There are people that like the awnings, and there are people that don't like the awnings.
What kind of awnings?
Well, they're fabric awnings, and they're permanent. You don't roll them back.
Yeah.
Or you replace them when they really get full of pigeon manure.
There's a type of awning that's called a bubble awning they're kind of curved and often have lights underneath them, and it gives you the impression of a giant neon strip along the front of the building.
Oh, no, these aren't lit.
Okay.
They're nice if you're walking in the rain.
We can, in the Seattle area, the University of Washington, there's a street called University Way, and it's called the Ave.
Uh-huh.
And over in the, probably in the 50s, up to the 50s, it was really kind of a neat little place, and it was okay in the 60s. They still had the JCPenney, so that those of us who were at the U who needed, you know, to quickly run over and buy something, and they had a Woolworths. And then all those people moved out. There was a really nice Miller and Pollard furniture store. And, you know, the street became a gathering place for indigent kids, you know, runaways, and they blocked the sidewalks, and then people moved out. There was a wonderful delicatessen that had been there forever, and they got booted out by McDonald's. Now McDonald's is closed because all of the street kids would just go in there and hang out. So now they're trying to refurbish it, but I'm not sure how successful, because everybody that's had like Miller and Pollard left and all these other neat little shops, and now it's all, not to say anything against ethnic foods, but the whole thing is just one ethnic food place after another.
Well, I think you've hit on something that I mentioned the other day, which is preservation increasingly is looking at not just the buildings, but also kind of vitality of communities.
Right.
And it's a much tougher issue. It's pretty easy to fix a building.
Yeah.
And it's real hard to go in and you know, make a community work. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly something that's part of the ethic these days. And something that people are working on.
They need to address the problem of the young people first, and then do something about the buildings.
Right. The first thing they've done is redone the streets and the sidewalks, and they've gone back to old-fashioned lights. I mean, they really neat old lights, and they're trying more foot officers to say, you know, you kids need to be kind of finding a life someplace. Or something, but it's hard to walk on the streets. And I have a friend who is legally blind, and she finds it very difficult to move because they'll just sit in little groups, and they won't. Either they don't know what a white stick means, or what. But it's very hard for her to move through that area. But she
knowing the way it used to be, it's really kind of hard.
They had a beautiful Porter and Jensen jewelry that had been there since ever, and they finally pulled that about 4 months ago, and you're going, oh no, we're just refurbishing, don't move yet. So
we had some problems in my small town of Hermosa Beach, California, and they decided to create a pedestrian mall on the street that went down to the pier, and they got a little carried away with obsessing about, they didn't want street people and they didn't want people staying too long, so they put in these benches that you had to jump to get up to the seat, and the seats, they didn't want anybody lying around there.
Well,
and since you've taken those out and put in benches where you can actually sit and enjoy it.
I don't know if I had to jump to get on a bench.
With a cup of coffee? It's messy.
When they put our, we have a Metro bus tunnel to try and
get. Yeah, I've been in that tunnel.
Well, though, thinking of seats, it's a long like marble bench, but there are
so people don't.
So if you lay down on it, you know, you're going to have a big triangle in your hip or something. So it has kept people from thinking they're going to be down there all day.
There are solutions. Some are better.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is always a concern of the people who live there. You know, you want it to be adorable, but you don't want it to be so conducive that you are the destination point of the shopping
day.
Cart.
Yeah. Right.
Crowd.
Yeah. Hard.
Do they have lists of, like in Minnesota, of all the sites in Minnesota that are historical significance?
Yes, we have, and I think many states, if you have access to a computer, you can find that on the internet through the National Park Service website. Our office also publishes, I probably should have brought one along, but I didn't know if there'd be anybody from Minnesota. Would ever be in Minnesota? A little book about this high and about this wide that's designed to fit perfectly into your glove compartment. That lists all of our National Register properties. And it's really, even my kids drag this thing out. We're driving down the road and everybody's head snaps. And
do the milepost book list those things too? You know, when you're Milepost 99, and there's something there, or Milepost 29.
I'm not familiar with those.
Oh, yeah, those are yours.
Okay. But I would. Maybe the more public things would be in there. A lot of National Register stuff's just in a neighborhood somewhere. You're driving along, and there's a house, and you might not notice anything unusual about it, but it's where somebody famous lived, or something important happened. And
I think that tape.
Yeah, that was a great
What is your Iowa background? I went to Grinnell College.
Oh, you did? Well, I went to the University of Iowa, just down the road. But my dad did work for Grinnell Mutual Reinsurance Company for years and years, so I spent a lot of time in Grinnell riding along with him on business trips.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in north central Iowa, 20 miles from Minnesota. So I've been almost a Minnesotan all my life, but didn't take the plunge till
clearly married.
Yeah, sure you betcha.
Yeah.
So where did you graduate?
University of Iowa for undergraduate, and then Cornell University for graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you the one when you introduced yourself? You said you had a vocation of this, and then you've changed.
Yeah, this is second shot for me. I was an advertising guy before I was a preservation guy.
Okay. Well,
so you have to figure out the connection there. I can't.
Well, in advertising, you're certainly meeting with a lot of people or through your lifetime or something.
But most of my career has been in nonprofits, so that's even the advertising part. So.
Mm.
Well, I'm happy to chat, but you're also, if you want coffee, you can stay.
Thank you. Are you familiar with the theater in Redwood?
Yeah, the Shelton. That's a nice town. That's a beautiful
town.
Redwood.
Yeah,
you guys have some pretty neat stuff in Rochester, too. The Barnes & Noble bookstore. And the,
that was a great restoration.
Yeah.
We went here thinking somebody's going to come up and tear that down.
It's
a beautiful
park.
Oh, yeah. You know, our armory is what I think is here. That's an
You know, maybe you could leave an address and I'll mail you one.
Okay.
The one now. Which one are you talking about? Did they make them large?
No, one downtown.
That's hard to do. That's unfortunate.
No, Barnes and Noble.
Old hotel rooms always were
small.
I don't know. It's
more comfortable.
I'm interested in your comments. Let's talk about that. I'll make sure. Get some of this in on
you know,
Friday.
I was sitting here thinking, it's nice to
read
a lot of those buildings coming down.
Of course, we're
the people that live on the street.
Yeah.
Because they don't replace them.
Seniors.
This is from the senior citizen.
They
can't
call the
for a long time.
We're camped in
a couple of places in Ellsbury just flat out burned down.
And my personal experience, I'll leave Sharon.
Mostly older gentlemen live.
Until she bails in.
And,
but my experience with Holden was the two-shot experience.
The city doesn't allow much building or living upstairs.
That was the time you were sort of stranded on the lake.
Yes.
Unless you do some really heavy remodeling, which raises
just anxious to get back.
They don't like people living upstairs.
You know, I said, I want to be there on Thanksgiving. I want to be there on
Christmas. Well, you know, it's a problem for our whole country because we are tending more and more to get to this wide division in income levels. And the very top doesn't seem to be there when we create that imbalance.
After that experience,
that increased division eventually destroyed the market.
They were really nice too. They aren't like
Holden is just be like that. But I can hardly wait.
But my stars, those things were like this. And in the middle of winter, when you can't get anything with inside.
I was surprised because we're coming in a while from the
It bothers me.
And we don't know anything. Whoa, we're driving by these fields, and then you get to town, you buy onions by the bushel bag.
Oh, yeah.
We still like we usually do.
I have trouble finding the little ones that I can boil and then put the cheese sauce on. They have strawberries down there too.
Hints of dissatisfaction. I'm hearing the answers.
No, you can't buy a single one in the grocery store.
Really?
Or
wrong,
if you're going to, on your way home, take them home, cut them up.
A poor example maybe is they couldn't and wouldn't want to take the sinks out of the room. And I applaud that because I think if you're going to have a bathroom down the hall, a sink.
But it also has to have water flowing through it. Is that where we're...
Well, they could be up about 3 feet.
Okay.
Well, those,
you know, for
those
me,
sinks have faucets. Yeah. You know, any kind of sink you want to put in my room is okay with me. But if they put springs on those faucets, which limits my use, and makes it necessary for me, if I'm going to wash my hands in it, to put a plug in the bottom. And,
the nurse would applaud you on that.
Well,
keep it clean. Yeah.
That's not clean water when you wash your hands.
Mm-hmm. And then I think the bedding is, there's many opportunities for, now they tell me that they're at capacity for most of this one, if not all.
It varies from year to year, but it's pretty full here. Full means probably 320 to 400 people. Mm-hmm. 400's unusual, but 350 is pretty common.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's crowded.
So I see nothing the matter with increasing the rates. I think to come to the Holden B&B and pay $60 is a gift. No, if they'd said 100, I would have said delighted to be here. I'm getting breakfast. You have a chance to get to know two delightful women, and everything about it is great. But they don't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think. Let me just jump in a little bit, and we can pursue this because Holden has deteriorated a whole bunch since I first came here. Mm-hmm. And the reasons are sort of twofold. One is almost everything here is done with volunteer labor, which means a couple things. One is if you want good electrical work done, you wait till a good electrician volunteers. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you got people who maybe haven't done this before doing the work. Mm-hmm. But that's been the pattern, you know, good or bad, that's been what it's been for 40 years. And it's, you can see the effects all over the place.
Yeah.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I think the board finally recognized that Holden was
deteriorating faster than they were trying to.
Well, it just can't keep up.
Maintained, yeah.
And so for the first time in the history of this place, they launched a capital campaign to raise some money to actually start to deal with some of these things. And you're here midstream, and actually maybe the first third stream. But the money is finally sort
of keep
there.
Us in the first third.
And you're in a lodge that I don't think has been particularly dealt with. Some of the others have been. They're kind of making their way around.
Yeah.
But it's a real problem. And it's one that for many years just wasn't satisfactorily addressed. And I think the current administrators are working pretty hard on it, but it's going to take a while.
Because
there's a lot of time, lost time to make up for.
Yeah.
Well, what I was concerned about is that historic preservation there was at least the potentiality for that to be used as an excuse for not doing the things that I think are basic.
No, and that, I mean, that I'm doing two things while I'm here. I'm doing the classes in the mornings, but I've also been, I'm here to help Holden write a preservation plan that will allow them to make some of those repairs without irrevocably, let me get that word out, altering the character of the place. And it's a delicate balancing act. I would say Holden is set to go gung-ho, wants to get these things done, and it's been that negotiation with the Forest Service that's been kind of a thorn. So my intention is to try to help run interference, and you know, not everything has to be turned into a museum. You talked about the sinks. There's no reason we can't have a